as I've observed in other classes, we're going a little bit out of order in terms of the book order in the Old Testament. But I hope that the way these studies are arranged, that you're getting a fuller sense of not only what the Old Testament says about the Messiah, but the way that those images are being built and used and prepared for Christ to come and fulfill them. So we'll spend three classes in Isaiah because of its importance for our understanding of the Messiah. Our objectives for today are a little bit organizational, maybe, rather than purely textual, but I think it'll be good for us. We'll look at the text and we'll see how the book is put together, which will establish some context for what we're going to talk about in the next two classes. So by the end of the class today, I hope you'll have named at least three themes of the book of Isaiah and explain the simplified three-part division or organization of the book. So here's this periods of messianic prophecy slide that I've been showing every time. In Isaiah occurs in this later kingdom period when we're getting into very detailed images and descriptions. But Isaiah, as a book, represents an explosion of messianic detail, both in its historical context, meaning if you read the book as the original audience would have read it, it's an explosion of messianic detail. And it's also an explosion of detail, messianic detail, from a messianic perspective. That is, reading it as we would, as those who believe that Jesus is the fulfillment of those prophecies. You read through the Old Testament, you get to Isaiah, and there's way more detail than you've experienced so far in your reading. So, Isaiah is significant for those reasons. We'll talk more about the place of Isaiah in messianic revelation in the third class, when we'll focus just on Isaiah 53. There's so much in that chapter that we felt like it was a good idea to just focus on that one. and it will be a Sunday, which is appropriate. But today we're going to look at an outline of Isaiah, the themes of Isaiah, and examine those themes in as they occur in chapters 1 through 40. In class 2, Grady will teach that on Wednesday. We'll be looking at chapters 41 to 66 and really focusing in on the work of the servant, who is such a key feature of those chapters. So, here's the simplified outline of Isaiah. This is very heavily adapted from Kyle and Dalich's commentary on the Old Testament, meaning if it sounds like a fifth grader wrote it, that's me. If it doesn't, that's Kyle.
Did they go here?
No, they're dead. Have been for about 100 years or so. Maybe longer. Those are the last names, Chester, not their first names, sorry. So, basically, you can divide the book into two or three sections. I guess it depends on how you're feeling. We're going to talk about the three-way division because I think it helps us to kind of understand the text a little bit better to divide it up a little bit more. Basically, in the first 35 chapters, punishment is promised. Note the alliteration. That was me. No, Kyle Dalich. Punishment is promised on Judah and Jerusalem, on the surrounding nations in chapters 13 to 27, and then you have this sixfold woe of destruction in chapters 28 to 35. And so that first section really deals with Israel's history, or Israel and Judah in a historical context. That is, as the nation of Israel is taken into Assyrian captivity, and Judah is sort of inevitably headed for Babylonian captivity, chapters 1 through 35 kind of deal with those issues. The second shortest section of the book is really, I call it Hezekiah's history, again, because they both start with the same letter. But these are the stories that you're familiar with of the Assyrian attack on Jerusalem that's repelled by the angel of the Lord. Hezekiah gets sick and recovers through the intervention of Isaiah. And then Hezekiah, shows off to the Babylonian officials And as a result, judgment is announced on Judah, that they will be taken into captivity. And 39 ends with a really sad detail of Hezekiah going, well, at least it's not going to happen in my day, right? So that's good. Great. And then the third section is what Grady will talk about next time, what I'm calling the messianic messages. Again, alliteration. But basically that God hears and helps his people. And then the details about the rejection and suffering of God's servant, chapter 49 and 57. And ending the book with this vision of restoration and the future glory of Israel. Now, I've called the third section messianic messages. That's not to say that the first section of the book is all doom and gloom. As we'll see, it does offer really, actually quite incredible hope, both to Israel and to us. But the first part is much more deeply rooted in the then current reality of Israel being taken into captivity and Judah's destruction becoming an inevitable certainty. And so, sort of on balance, the first part of the first half of the book because it's sort of more focused in the present, which is all about destruction, it is a little bit less optimistic, maybe, than the second half. But if you can remember those six words, punishment promise, Hezekiah's history, and messianic messages, that is a very, very, very rough outline of the book of Isaiah. By the way, I should say, we're not going to get into a lot of detail about the book of Isaiah in any of these classes. And we're trying to cover 66 chapters in three class periods. We're going to leave some stuff out. So I apologize for that in advance. And if I get anything wrong because I'm summarizing it so broadly, I'd be glad for you to correct me. But just kind of be aware that that's going to happen. I'm looking specifically at Danny in this case. Sorry, David. Anyway, so there's the first objective, the three-part simplified outline. I almost said simplistic outline of Isaiah, but you get the idea. All right, so here is the second objective, the themes of Isaiah. Let's turn to Isaiah chapter 6. This is, of course, Isaiah's call to prophecy. And what's significant about this, and a lot of things significant about Isaiah's vision here in chapter 6, both as an event in history and also in its context in the book. But what I want us to see is that in this vision, we have the themes of Isaiah encapsulated in just a few verses. These themes are going to drive Isaiah's prophecies of both near and far-term events. In other words, everything Isaiah has to say about what God's going to do in the future is related to these six themes. And so it's not, I think, coincidental that they all show up so clearly here in this vision in chapter 6. So the first theme of Isaiah is the exaltation of Jehovah as king. We're going to talk about three of these in more detail, so I'm just going to summarize them and show them here in chapter 6. But notice that in chapter 6, verse 1, God is sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, the train of his robe filling the temple. It's a kingly vision of God, and God is king and has become king in this vision. The second theme of Isaiah is holiness as a defining characteristic of the Lord. Verse 3, a verse we're all familiar with, the creatures who are around him call out to one another and say, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." Again, the threefold holy cry is a statement of superlative holiness, highlighting God's holiness, not just as a characteristic of God, but as a defining characteristic that is essential to his nature. It is who he is, that he is holy, holy, holy. In the second half of verse 3, you see the next one, which is the universality of Jehovah's kingdom. The whole earth is full of his glory, meaning not just that his glory goes that far, but if his glory goes that far, his reign also extends that far. And so this will become an important theme in Isaiah as Isaiah begins to describe this kingdom that's going to come, that's going to, you know, fill the earth. That's going to overtake all the other nations, overtake all the other kingdoms with the reign of God. You get a sense of that here, even in this initial vision. The fourth theme is the sinfulness of Jehovah's chosen people. Again, this is not uncommon in the prophets, where the prophet will sort of be a stand-in for all of God's people. And so when Isaiah says, "Woe is me, for I am ruined, because I am a man of unclean lips. I live among a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." He's not only summarizing the people's sinfulness when he says a people of unclean lips, but he's actually typifying that sinfulness by himself, you know, by confessing his own sin, his own unworthiness before this perfectly holy God. And that's going to characterize a lot of Isaiah's message, which is that because of Israel and Judah's sins, God's going to have to punish them. But he's not only going to punish them, he's going to redeem them and cleanse them, which is, of course, what happens to Isaiah here in this vision, that the seraphim flies to him with a burning coal, touched it to my mouth and says, "Behold, this has touched your lips, your iniquity is taken away and your sin is forgiven." There has to be punishment for sin, but Isaiah is very clear about the fact that there will also be forgiveness and cleansing made available. And so we see that in this vision, and it becomes this grand theme in the book of Isaiah, as well as in the whole Bible. The fifth theme, which we'll talk about in more detail, is the people's inability to hear the word of God. That's verse 9. Go tell this people, keep on listening, but do not perceive. Keep on looking, but do not understand. The people's unwillingness to listen, and in fact, they're not just unwillingness, but actual inability to hear. We'll talk about it in just a minute, but that rejection is a part of their sinfulness, and it's a part of what leads them into captivity. And then the sixth theme, verses 11 through 12, Isaiah asks, "How long do I have to do this? How long will this go on?" And God says, "Well, it's until cities are devastated without inhabitant, till houses are without people, and the land is utterly desolate, and the Lord has removed men far away, and the forsaken places are many in the midst of the land." That is apocryphal language in the sense that it's kind of saying until everything's gone, in a sort of final apocalyptic sense. But it's also true in a very immediate sense. That is, until God punishes his people, until he takes them away into captivity. And so the people will be exiled, but then they will return, and that's verse 13, there will be a tenth portion in it, and it will again be subject to burning like a terebinth rope, whose stump remains when it is felled, the holy seed that is its stump. The people will be exiled, but they will return to the land. And we'll talk about that one as well. So we're going to talk about the ones that are in bold here, because I think they, all of these themes really find their ultimate expression in Christ's person, life, and salvation. So we could talk about all of them, but we don't have time. So I chose three that I think kind of give us the best scope, the best view of what Isaiah is talking about about the Messiah in the book, which are the exaltation of Jehovah as King, the people's inability to hear the word of Jehovah, and the people's exile and return. So this first theme, exaltation of Jehovah as King. One of the things that's significant about the vision in Isaiah 6 is that it happens in the year that King Uzziah died. This is a time when there's some turmoil in the land. I mean, the successor has been named, but the transition of power is always fraught with uncertainty. As we know, even in a land where we know who the next leader is going to be because we, in a sense, chosen him to be the next leader, or at least some of us voted for him. We choose him, but there's still that uncertainty, right? It's like, I don't know what's the transition going to be like? What's this new ruler going to be like in the land? And in this time, Isaiah sees this vision of God on his throne. In other words, even when human kings die or fail, God remains enthroned. And so Isaiah goes a long way towards resolving this tension that we saw in Psalms between the failure of Israel's kings and God's eternal kingship. And it's really one of his great contributions to Messianic prophecy that he starts to show us the solution to this problem of the earthly kings that fail and die and the heavenly king that reigns forever and yet has always promised a representative on earth, but that representative in David's line is always imperfect. And they get more imperfect the farther you go into Israel's history. And so Isaiah's resolution to that is that a king in the line of David will come to Israel. And this becomes a key point of Isaiah's text. So I'd like us to think about this question for a minute. How does Isaiah describe this coming king? What are some things that are unique about him? And what I'd like you to do is pick one set of these verses, so either 4:2 and 11:1-5, or 7:14, or 9:6-7, and take just a minute. You can work with the person next to you if they're working on the same verse, and see what you can find in these verses about this coming king. What is unique about him?
Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and you shall call his name Emmanuel. So, how does Isaiah describe this coming king, and what is unique about him? Being born of a virgin is pretty unique.
Yep. In God's love. Yep.
Good point.
Okay, but I'm hearing a lot of discussion, so I assume that means you have all the answers already. How is this king described? Let's start in 4:2 and 11:1-5. Anybody look at those? So what does 4:2 say?
It's talking about this branch of the Lord.
Right. Which sort of comes out of nowhere in Isaiah, meaning that this is the first time that this term is used, right? This branch of the Lord. And there's not really a lot more detail given about what that is. And that's why I included 11:1-5. What does 11:1-5 say about this branch? Who is this branch, pardon the pun, rooted in and connected to?
Jesse.
Yeah, it's the root of Jesse, right? So this line of David. Anything else in 11:1-5 that you thought was significant as a description of the king?
The Spirit of the Lord will rest upon him, and then it goes on to explain. Almost, that term's been used before, I think, with other maybe prophets, but to go there and say the spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and might, the spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. It's almost like a perfect what he has will be different than what anyone else has in a complete sense.
Do you recognize any of this language that describes the king's reign here in chapter 11? Where have we seen this before? With righteousness he will judge the poor, side of fairness for the afflicted of the earth. I mean, what is that language typical of?
With righteousness? You're saying with...
Judging the poor, deciding with fairness for the afflicted of the earth, striking the earth with the rod of his mouth. It's kingship language. Right.
It's one of the Psalms.
A lot of the Psalms that talk about kingship, talk about judging fairly for the poor, judging the nations, the rod from Psalm 2. It's very typical kingship language, but as James is pointing out, this is the kingship perfected. We'll explore more of what that means. Okay, what about 7:14?
Oh, that's the prophecy of a virgin birth.
Right. And we'll talk about what that means in just a second, but that's pretty unique, right? I mean, that's not the kind of thing you can explain away easily if it were actually to take place.
Chester pointed out the name Emmanuel.
Right.
God with us. So
good.
That is also a very unique thing.
Yes. Yeah. Both in terms of how many people in the Old Testament actually have that name, which, if I remember correctly, is zero, and also just what it means, right? And yeah, that's good. We'll explore that in just a minute. What about 9:6-7?
Everlasting nature.
Hey, good.
That theme's about that.
I'm sorry.
That theme is basically throughout those couple of verses. There.
That's right.
And then there's a description of his kingship.
Yes.
For a mighty God, the everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. But the everlasting part seems to run through that pretty strong.
Right, and that's important because if his reign is everlasting, then those all those other characteristics about being the Prince of Peace and a mighty God and a wonderful counselor, those all suddenly are amplified because he's not going away. Those characteristics that define him as a person are going to be available to his kingdom, to his people, forever because his kingdom will know him. Yes?
I kind of have two questions.
All right.
So there's a lot of language that kind of revolves around a tree, like shooting David or something, Jesse, like this branch of David,
yeah.
And then even going back to Abraham, like the seed of Abraham. Is there a connection between all of those three, like to be a, like an image of a tree?
I would say yes and no, in the sense that no, in the sense that they are not necessarily explicitly like all tied together into a singular image. You see what I'm saying? Like a like almost like a parable or something. But yes, in the sense that I think there is this image of a tree that runs all the way through the Bible, right? And you see kind of. Again, more puns, offshoots of that image that sort of sprout. Sorry, and help us to have a better sense of what God is accomplishing by putting it in picture form. So there's the tree of life at the beginning, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That's sort of the source of the fall, in the sense that they ate that fruit, right? And at the end of the Bible, you have the tree of life that's at the throne, you know what I mean? And in between, you have the story of basically of us trying to get back to the tree of life. And you see these images of trees and branches and sprouts that occur all through the Bible. And I think we're intended to sort of see that we are building back to that tree of life at the end. Yes, Dave?
Also, I guess, you know, to the people that are reading this, they have the image. We don't see it, but if you walk all over that land, see an olive tree and that's been cut, it will have a shoot coming out of it. So anyone reading this in that time, walking in that land, knows exactly the description that's being given there.
Yeah, so there is both that immediate, you know, sort of reality of the image in their minds. Oh, I understand that. But there's also, I do think there is this sort of subtle, you know, image of a tree that undergirds the entirety of Scripture and that surfaces in places. But I don't know if I would say, but I don't know that the Bible ever specifically says that here's how all these images tie together. You know,
right.
What I mean?
Right.
But that's a good, I mean, that's a good observation, and I think there's definitely something there.
And then would they have tied the seed promise to this Messiah?
Good, we're going to talk about that. That's a good question. Yeah. So the king in the line of David is going to be a shoot of David, as we observed in chapter 4 and chapter 11. And it's described in chapter 40, in fact, verses 9 through 11, this is the last question on your lesson sheet, as being a shepherd king ruling from Jerusalem, like David, but who was also proclaimed to be God. And so you have the idea that we saw in Psalms of David perfected here, described in chapter 40. This king is going to be an offspring of David. He will be born miraculously of a virgin, and we said. The important thing about chapter 7 is not just that it contains the verse about born of a virgin. I mean, that is important, obviously. But in the context, Isaiah goes to Ahaz and says, ask for a sign. Ask for anything. And Ahaz says, oh, I can't do that. I'm not going to test God. Which is stupid. God said to told him to ask for a sign. He's not being modest. He's disobeying. God said, ask for it. And Ahaz says, oh, I'm not going to do that. That's rebellion. Right? And so Isaiah says, okay, you know what? I'm going to give you a sign that's so incontrovertible, no one will be able to argue with it. So this virgin birth is the sign that Isaiah promises. And because it is from God, there's no other way that a virgin could bear a child like that. It's not someone who's claiming to be trying to claim the earthly dynasty, because he wasn't born when he was conceived in that way, right? So In the context of Isaiah, there's more political intrigue that's going on, into which this this sign of the virgin birth is contextualized, about the dynasty. But we need to see this in context, that this is intended to be it's down here somewhere. Maybe it's later, I can't remember. But I'll come back to that, remind me. Anyway, as we saw in chapter 9 and in chapter 7, this king that in the line of David that will come is given names, but names that indicate his purposes, what he comes to do. So he's going to be Emmanuel, God dwelling among his people. He's going to be the wonderful counselor, that is wisdom incarnate, which is actually really what Paul calls him in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 30, Christ the wisdom of God. He's going to be mighty God. And that's important because, unlike the king in Psalms, he is not simply a deputized representative. Right? Now, we understand that ultimately Psalm 2 and Psalm 110 and others are talking about Christ, but they're also talking about the physical king of Judah in the line of David, who is a deputized representative of God. God makes him his son. Isaiah's king is not made God's son. He is God already. He has that inherently. So he's called Mighty God. He's the everlasting father. That is, he's the beginning of a great people, right? The idea of a father is one who produces offspring. But he's also everlasting. He's from eternity, which again is a claim to divinity. And the Prince of Peace, meaning that he is a maker of peace. And Paul talks about that in Ephesians chapter 2 as well. Oh yeah, I forgot about this one. In Matthew 1, that's the angel telling Joseph that he will be Emmanuel and God will dwell among them. In the context, of course, of the virgin birth in Matthew 1, which was prophesied in chapter 7. And this kingdom will also be a continuously expanding and eternal kingdom, chapter 9, verse 7. So, one thing that's significant about Isaiah is writing at the same time that many of the Psalms were written. And in fact, his ministry begins really at the same time that books 1 and 2 of the Psalms are compiled. And so you can see that he's wrestling with the same problem that the Psalms are, which is this brokenness of Judah's kingship and God's promise that he would give them a king on the throne. And so where the Psalms only contemplate the present failure and disaster in light of the past promises, in other words, they look back and they say, what you promised God doesn't match our reality, Isaiah, by the grace of God, is able to look forward and see how this tension is going to be resolved. And that's why Isaiah is one of many reasons that Isaiah is significant in our understanding of Messiah. So that's this first theme of Isaiah, and I've mostly highlighted it in the first 39 chapters because that's really what I'm focusing on today, but it obviously continues through into the latter half of the book as well. Anything else about this theme, Jehovah as king through his servant who is also the king and is also God? All right. Talk about the next one, people's inability to hear the word. So in Isaiah 6:9, when Isaiah is commissioned, God tells him, look, they're not only not going to listen, but I want you to tell them to keep not listening. Which is a really depressing way to start your preaching career, right? All right, good luck. Nobody's going to listen to you. Why do you think God tells Isaiah that? Why do you think he says no one's going to listen? And look at Isaiah chapter 29, verses 9 through 14 for some more context. Take just a minute and look at Isaiah 29 and see what you come up with.
Okay. The words of the book that is sealed, which men deliver to one who is literate, saying, read this, please. And he says, I cannot, for it is sealed. Then the book is delivered to one who is illiterate, saying, read this, please. And he says, I am not literate. So, kind of even here, verse 10. For the Lord has poured out on you the spirit of deep sleep and has closed your eyes, namely the prophets, and he has covered your heads, namely the seers. So, where he's talking about, where Mason's talking about the people not hearing.
Okay, so what do you think? Why is God telling Isaiah that no one's going to listen? Maybe another way to ask the same question is, why aren't they listening, and why does God think Isaiah needs to know that? Probably should have asked that question instead.
CBS News. Now, watch Sunday Morning Now.
What looks like explanation in verse 11. They can't. It's sealed.
Right.
And they can't read it, and even though they can't read, they say the kids. They say the twice.
Yeah, verse 11 is interesting. It kind of seems like, I think maybe the point is they're going about understanding God's will the wrong way. They're trying to look into things they don't need to know about. So they take to somebody and says, I can't read that. It's sealed. That's not for me. That's what they do. It being sealed is it's not for me. And so they go from bad to worse. They go, okay, well, we'll ask somebody else who doesn't mind breaking the seal. They're like, I can't read anyway. So
unmet expectation seems to be the thing that's blinding them.
I think that's part of it. Right, they're looking for something and they're not seeing it, and therefore anything else that is told to them that doesn't match, they just ignore. I think that's part of it. What else do you see? I mean, what about 9 and 10? What's the point there?
They seem to be drunk but not wine and intoxicated.
And why? Who's responsible for this?
Verse 13 says that their hearts are far from them. So if your hearts are not, and just like the actual parables, those who weren't willing to look and to seek, it wasn't revealed to them.
Yep. Yep. And what about verse 10?
Did the Lord pour it out? The spirit of deep sleep?
Yeah. So how are they being limited in their understanding? Second half of verse 10.
Yeah. And the prophets would speak, they paid no attention.
I think that's true, but I don't think that's actually what he's saying in verse 10.
But the prophets were even blinded.
Yeah. That. By who?
God.
By God. God says, nope, you're not going to see. I'm going to make it so you can't. So the people's inability to hear the word is an important part of what Isaiah wants to communicate. They've already chosen not to see and hear and understand. That's why he begins in chapter 6 by saying, keep on seeing but not perceiving. Keep on hearing listening but not hearing, whatever. God's going to make this attitude part of their punishment, though. It's going to be not just, well, this is what I'm going to do. God says, okay, I'm going to take that and make it even worse for you by removing your eyes and your ears, the prophets and the seers, in verse 10. And to the point that in chapter 8, verse 14, this prophecy of the cornerstone, even the salvation that God offers is going to be an opportunity to stumble. And we would think, well, if God's going to save them, why would he make it so hard for them? And it's because they've chosen not to listen. They've chosen to stumble over it, and so God says, okay, well, I put it there. I'm telling you that I put it there, and you're still tripping over it. They've chosen not to, and God makes that a part of their punishment. And even when they do obey, even their obedience is rebellious. Ahaz pretends humility and refuses to request a sign that God commanded him to request in chapter 7. Again, that's disobedience. That's rebellion. And so even him pretending, even Ahaz showing feigned, though it is, humility and deference to God, even that's a sin because he's rebelling against God in doing it. Their worship is hypocritical, 29:13. They draw near with their words, they honor me with their lips, but they remove their hearts far from me. And their relationship with God, when you boil it down, is just ritual and tradition, 29:13. Their reverence for me consists of tradition learned by rote, or the way the Septuagint translates it and then is used in the New Testament, it, teaching its doctrines, the commandments of men. But it's the same idea, right? It's that their idea of what God wants is just what other men have said that God wants, instead of what God actually wants from his people. So they've chosen not to see or to understand. But through the Messiah, God will restore sight and hearing to his people. 29:18, God says, "On that day the deaf will hear words of a book, and out of their gloom and darkness the eyes of the blind will see. The afflicted also will increase their gladness in the Lord, and the needy of mankind will rejoice in the Holy One of Israel." God's going to restore sight and healing. And those images of sight and healing are all the way through the book. You see in chapter 9, verse 2, the very famous prophecy about Galilee being the place where the Messiah would operate. "From Galilee of the Gentiles, light will dawn, so that those who are sitting in darkness can see. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them." In chapter 40, "All flesh will see the glory of the Lord revealed." I just got nervous that I didn't remember that correctly. Luke quotes Isaiah 40 verse 5 in describing the ministry of John the Baptist, that the glory of the Lord will be, all flesh will see the salvation or the glory of God, chapter 40, verse 5. This healing of their sight and their hearing is not just sort of better access to a knowledge of God. It's actually the beginning of a recreation. 35, 4 through 10. God will come with vengeance. The recompense of God will come, but he will save you. Then the eyes of the blind will be opened. The ears of the deaf will be unstopped. The lame will leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute will shout for joy. And then this is the recreation part. Waters will break forth in the wilderness, and streams in the Arabah. The scorched land will become a pool, and the thirsty ground springs of water. In the haunt of jackals, its resting place, grass becomes reed and rushes. A highway will be there, a roadway, and it will be called the Highway of Holiness. So the whole world is being recreated as a result of this restoration. And in Acts 3, the sermon that Peter and John preach in the temple, they say, by proclaiming that Jesus is the Messiah, but they end by saying, "Obey so that times of refreshing may come." And I think what they're referring to are these images of recreation and restoration in Isaiah, that God is going to refresh the whole landscape. It's going to be remade into something beautiful. And I think they are intending their audience to see that time that had been prophesied is upon them in the New Covenant. The purpose of this healing that God is going to bring about will be to reveal God to them. Chapter 33, verse 17, "Your eyes will see the king in his beauty. They will behold a far distant land." In John 9, the whole chapter of John 9 in some ways is almost like a fulfillment of this, of the literal and symbolic meaning of restoring sight that Isaiah talks about. Because Jesus literally heals a blind man. And that blind man then is able to understand that Jesus is God with very little kind of prior knowledge of who Jesus is. He's able to reason that this guy must be from God. And then Jesus comes to him and says, "Do you believe in the Son of God?" And he says, "Well, I don't know who that is." And Jesus says, "That's me." And the man says, "Lord, I believe." And then Jesus ends by saying to the Pharisees, "Because you say you have no sin, behold, you're still blind." That's the sort of literal and metaphorical application of this point of Isaiah, right? This healing and this restoration is not just about improving their physical circumstances. It's about revealing God to them. And Jesus does that in John 9 in a very literal way by literally healing a man who had been born blind. So it's a very poignant and meaningful demonstration of this principle from Isaiah. And in fact, Jesus claims this, this healing, this recreation, as his mission in Luke chapter 4. He's quoting from Isaiah 61 there, which we'll talk about probably next time. So I'm not going to talk about that. I don't steal anything that Grady wants to say. But I do want to point out that this mission of restoring sight and healing for much greater and grander purposes is something that Jesus claims as his work in Luke chapter 4. So Christ's mission was not simply to speak the same truth louder, or to overwhelm anyone with inescapable arguments of God's righteousness. Just as the people didn't want to see and hear in Isaiah's time, they didn't want to see and hear in Christ's time either. And so Jesus quotes these verses to them to explain their behavior. He wasn't going to just blast them with the truth and force them to accept it. What he did was to reveal something new, to reveal God among us, offering himself as a redemption to inaugurate a perfect covenant and establish an eternal kingdom. The people who rejected Isaiah and Christ rejected them because they did not want to see the truth, not because it was inescapable. To learn the truth, the first thing they had to do was to admit their need. That's John chapter 9, verse 41, because you say, we can see your sin remains. Until we admit our need, the truth is going to be hidden from us. If you think about it, Israel had an inescapable confrontation with God at Sinai, right? The voice that spoke from the mountain, and they couldn't stand to listen to it. It was pretty inescapable to them that God was real, that he was there, that he was revealing important things to them, and yet they rejected him almost immediately, right? And so in the new covenant, I think what God is doing is saying, okay, fine. We're not going to do it that way. I mean, he's not changing his mind, but he's saying, we're not going to do it that way anymore. Being present and experiencing the truth, instead of being inescapable like in Mount Sinai, it's going to be voluntary. You come. You figure it out. And as Barry alluded to, Jesus uses this principle in explaining why he preaches and he taught in parables, right? And in fact, he even quotes Isaiah in 6 in that context. To say it's so they won't understand unless they really want to. That's the way this new covenant is going to work. And so God solves this problem of the people's inability to hear the word by basically making them decide whether they want to hear it or not, offering the choice to them instead of trying to force it upon them. All right. Anything else about this theme?
You mentioned I would think about the Pharisees, how they thought they were worshiping God, and the same thing God says in 2 Thessalonians that you don't love the truth. I'm going to let you believe a lie.
Yep.
And the reason why is because you don't want to know the truth. You don't love the truth, so I'm just going to hit. You think that's fine? That's fine. Because again, you have to see your need and then follow what's there.
Yep.
If you're trying to feed yourself with these things, God said, okay, that's fine. Like I said, not going to force you.
Right.
You are doing this to yourself.
Yep. Yep. And I really think that makes God's salvation all the more glorious because it is, he is, and I think that's the significance of phrases like a people for his own possession, this intimate relationship with God that is only possible if both participants are willing. You can't be good friends with someone who doesn't want to talk to you, right? And so God is showing himself to his people in this way so that they will have to choose whether they want to serve him or not, which makes not only the relationship more glorious, but the judgment more justified on those who disobey.
In Isaiah 2, when he said, let us go up to the mountain.
Right.
God's going to... He's going to teach us. He's going to show us the way. So again, it's like let's go up there for him.
Yes.
To give us this, and we're going to respond in this way.
Right. And that image of all the nations, it's easy to read that as, and in fact, the Jews did read it as, well, God's just going to force them all to come up here. But if you think about it, even in that text, the language is of voluntary service. Let us go up to that.
Right.
So that theme of voluntary service is definitely there. And we even saw it in Psalm 110 that people offer themselves willingly. And that, I think, is important. All right, good. So the last theme we'll talk about today is the people's exile and return. So in a historical sense, because of their sins, Israel and Judah were going to go into exile. That's obviously an important part of Isaiah's message. But equally important as the reality of that judgment is the standards by which that judgment will be enacted. And that's the significance of the cornerstone prophecy in Isaiah 28. Therefore, thus says the Lord, I am laying in Zion a stone, a tested stone, a costly cornerstone, with the foundation firmly placed. He who believes in it will not be disturbed. In the context, what Isaiah is saying is that the city is so corrupt, there's not even a way to like determine what's right and wrong. So God says, okay, I'm going to put a standard in place. I'm going to put this perfectly square stone there, and everything's going to be measured off of that. And that's it's about the judgment of Israel and Judah. And so he says in verse 17, I will make justice the measuring line, righteousness the level. Then hail will sweep away the refuge of lies, and waters will overflow the secret place. The secret place there, you can kind of think of it as like, somebody built their house really poorly and they ended up with like a 6-square-foot space that got walled up because there was no other way to deal with it. Like, that's what we're talking about, right? It's like you're so out of plumb that you're building stuff and ending up with secret spaces in the construction. God says, I'm going to get rid of that. I'm going to set up a standard and everything's going to be measured by that, and everything that doesn't fit the standard is going to be removed. It's significant, though, that Isaiah predicts Judah's downfall, which is what he's talking about here, while Israel's downfall is happening. And we shouldn't forget that Isaiah's descriptions of the future destruction of Jerusalem are made more poignant by the current destruction of Israel. But, of course, God's going to restore his people. And you see this shift in emphasis about the restoration from just bringing back a remnant, which is kind of the focus, not exclusively, but largely in chapters 1 through 39, to a focus on the seed being preserved and revealed in chapters 40 through 66. As we've already observed, Gentiles will be included in this restored kingdom. The restoration is a new creation. We've seen that already, but it's highlighted again in other places in Isaiah as well. And for next time, restoration is personified in the suffering servant who experiences his own exile and restoration. Chapter 53 is a good example of that, which we'll examine in some detail. And as we've already observed in other places, Christ's rejection, suffering, and death become the means by which he ascends the throne of David. That is his personal exile and restoration. For next time, we will examine the second half of the book and great teaching guide. There are lessons right here, lesson 11. You grab those on the way out. Thank you for your attention.
Nice to meet you.
You too.